Oh, my gosh.
Boy, that's great.
That's classic.
The master's available. It's very
I get a dozen 8x10s and some pocket.
We're just returning from closed session, and now we're reconvening, and I will turn it over to our attorney, Martin.
Mayor, thank you.
Ms. Shumway, please come forward.
To the infinite spirit of us all, you have long shown us the way to listen with our hearts, to act with kindliness, and to be tolerant in our judgments. As we meet here tonight, working together for good, help us to remember that it is through the process of striving for harmonious living that we express your teachings. We offer to you our heartfelt gratitude for the guidance, patience, understanding, and love that flows unceasingly from your heart to ours. We ask you to help us listen well to your teachings, and in the listening, to find the peace that passeth understanding, where all things, all peoples, all joys, all sorrows stand in balance in your radiant love. May fearlessness, faith, hope, trust, joy, and love attend us in our work. Amen.
Amen. Let us not forget our service people overseas and at home. Okay, we are going to have the flag salute. And the flag salute tonight is going to be done by Ashley Collins. Ashley is 10 years old and a sixth grade student at Grover Beach Elementary School. Her favorite subject in school is math. She spends most of her time playing sports. I'm with you. Every Sunday she plays softball with the Flames, and on Saturdays she plays soccer with the Nightmares. She plans to start judo classes soon. Ashley's favorite part of playing sports is the time she's able to spend with her friends and her family. Ashley, would you like to come forward, please, and lead us?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Ashley, if you'd like to meet the rest of our council here. Councilmember Ekblom, Councilmember Lieberman, Mayor Pro Tem Scholes, and Councilmember Arnoldson.
Thank you. Good job. Nice to meet you.
And tonight we have a little something for you from us. There's a little proclamation for you, and a little goodie bag, and a pen to sign those important papers with. Okay. Thank you so much for leading us tonight. Right. May we have roll call, please?
Here.
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 Here. Tonight is great pleasure for me to be able to be a part of this and be here. And I would like to introduce our interim police chief, if you'd please come forward. And you can swear at us now. No.
Well, Madam Mayor, members of council, it is indeed a joyous occasion for this organization and this city. First of all, I'd like to thank my boss, city manager, for making sure that we came to the organization in 1991. He's done a number of things. Some of them are the rote things, detective, FTO, neighborhood watch. I became a corporal, one of the first corporals in 2001. He's been in charge of our CATS program, our very successful volunteer program, which really not only saves the city a lot of money, but involves this community into their own police department. It's been very effective, and Mark's been very active in doing that. He became our first and really our lead crisis negotiator at a time when things can turn to a very difficult situation for police departments dealing with hostage situations or potential suicides. Mark's specially trained, and it's his counsel, it's his calmness, it's his maturity that comes through in that, and that's why he was selected for that. Mark has been an acting sergeant since 2002 of July. And it has taken a certain fortitude to be in an acting position, provide direction for the people that you work with and may end up having to work for. It's a unique situation, and I'm very pleased to let you know that Mark not only did an outstanding job in that, but he did an outstanding job in testing for that position. He was actually number one on the position of the list that he made the acting on, and, of course, that list died. And he pulled it up again. He tested very well in this last process. I also want to recognize another class individual, and that's Angela Lamone, who's standing behind me. He's currently president of your Police Officers Association. He and Mark virtually tied for this, and it was very difficult. It was a pleasurable situation. I couldn't go wrong in either one of the selections, but after talking to staff, Mark had been working in that position. It was a difficult situation, but we had to make a pick, and I will tell you that Angelo stepped up and was one of the first to congratulate Mark. I really wish I had another position to put him into right now. So he's a bright star for your future and is a credit to the organization and his association. So, you know, I wish I had that opportunity. And something tells me he's going to be there real soon. But tonight, it is my pleasure to swear Mark in. So, Mark, you've done this before. If you remember all these words, you just go ahead and say them. Chiefs never remember these things, so thanks to Donna, we have the cheat sheet here. So we're going to raise your right hand. So far, we got that right. Okay. Now, you're going to respond to me at the end of this, but would you please say, do you, and please state your name. I,
Mark Pinza,
do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend.
That I will support and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of California.
And the Constitution of the State of California.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance.
To the Constitution of the United States.
To the Constitution of the United States.
And to the Constitution of the State of California.
And to the Constitution of the State of California.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully.
And that I will well and faithfully.
Discharge the duties upon which I'm about to enter.
Discharge the duties upon which I'm about to enter.
Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you, Chief.
It's a pleasure. Now, this is Mark's badge. He's been wearing it for 2.5 years. Some people thought there was Velcro on the back of it. That's all of you. And love you all. Okay? And Mark, you now get to say a couple words because I can't.
First of all, I want to...
Mark?
Yes.
Public speaking.
All I have is gratitude in my heart for everyone and for all that you've done in this... difficult time for me and my family, from the cards and meals. And my goodness, if anyone's ever hungry, if you're near San Luis, come to my house. We have food everywhere. This is a difficult time, and I just thank you all. I mean, it's heartwarming. I owe you all. I will be here, and I will serve you for now and forever. And my love and my heart for all of you. Thank you very much.
I would just like to say that I met Mark when our kids were in Little League. And if that's your little son, my God. Wow, son-in-law. But Mark, you were always there for your children and stuff, and you've always been there for our city, and I so appreciate it. Thank you so much.
I'd like to chime in, too. Mark's one of the four police officers that have been here longer than I have. There's only a few people in the city that have got more tenure than I do, and Mark is one of them, and he's always been a dedicated officer, just a fantastic, hardworking man, and most of all, a gentleman. Probably the best gentleman that I know in our department. What a great guy. Congratulations, Mark.
I want to jump in just because I used to work with Mark as a police dispatcher, and Mark was always one of those people that was very well-spoken, always interfaced extremely well with members of our community, provided really great customer service as far as I'm concerned. I do miss not seeing Mark running down my street on his lunch hour, and hope at some point we get that duty and honor of waving to you as you jog by huffing and puffing. So congratulations, Mark.
Anyone else? Okay, we're moving on. Public communications. Any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of this council. The council will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, the council cannot act on any items not on the agenda. Is there anyone out there that would like to speak? Please come forward.
Good evening. My name is Daniel Jones. I live at 921 Nice Avenue. I'm here to represent some of the neighbors from Nice Avenue. It's come to our attention that some type of special needs home or business has moved into the address at, or the home at the address of 941 Nice Avenue. And one of our questions is if the city's even aware that some type of business or we're going to, for lack of description, halfway house. And we've made phone calls to the city, we've made phone calls to the state, and we can't seem to get any answers. So we're coming here asking you if you can please, you know, get some information and get back to us. Since this these people have moved in, we don't even know how many people live there, but there's been an extremely large amount of traffic and pedestrians in and out of the place. It's just kind of, you know, all of a sudden it just got dumped on us, it seems like. And if there is a business there, we're just wondering why the neighborhood wasn't notified, because you've got notification for daycares and, you know, other types of businesses. And our biggest concern is that this is a real neighborhood. It's got, you know, kids playing on the streets. We've got, you know, people that really care about the neighborhood. And to have some type of business like this come into it, it's just really not in the flavor of our neighborhood. And we'd just like to, if we could, get some answers, please. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for bringing that forward.
Does staff have any knowledge of what's going
Thank
on?
You,
nice,
Steve.
Jake? Do we have an idea of what's going on there? Because I certainly don't, obviously.
Jake Raper, Community Development Director. I've had several conversations with a couple of residents regarding the activity. What I had provided to one of the gentlemen that I talked to is the state law and the zoning, planning and zoning laws that if it is an adult care facility, six or less, they're permitted by right. There are no zoning regulations that would be applicable to that type of operation occurring in a residential zone district. I've offered to follow up and contact the county to find out what their regulations and what their criteria is. If it is a facility where people are being compensated for housing transitional adults, then it would be regulated by the county. They would need to get a county permit or clearance through the, I think it's the, well, I can't think of the department that it would be.
Social Services.
Social Services, thank you. So there's a whole extensive state laws that regulate and preempts the local jurisdictions for a number of these types of facilities that could locate within single-family residential zone districts.
Is this a senior housing or a juvenile?
I have no idea. My understanding, it's adults.
And so they wouldn't be required to come to the city for any kind of occupancy permit or anything? Because I know in the past there was a teenage home on North 8th Street, and that was an issue where there was noticing and there was a discussion.
In past jurisdictions, when the state or the county notified the planning department that the facility was being proposed, we would send a letter out just advising them that the facility was being proposed within their neighborhood and gave them the contact number at the Capitol for them to call, because we were certainly preempted from any sort of regulations and or conditions for the establishment of that facility.
Do you think we could have this information for the next meeting?
I'm sure we can.
Okay.
If that's the desire of the council.
Definitely.
You need to come up to the... We have to do that because it's being recorded.
Cassandra Appleton, 1007 Nice Avenue, is at Men's Recovery Home, Drug and Alcohol Recovery Home.
So, Mr. Jones, the meeting that we're talking about is a week from tonight.
Is that going to find out how many beds are available, if it's six or under, or what are you going to find out?
If it's in compliance, I suppose, and get a hold of somebody from the county, I'm sure. Is that legal? Can we get that information? What is...
I think staff is intending to contact the county and establish exactly what type of facility is operated there and within what limits. And as Community Development Director identified, if it is six or under, state law controls their ability to locate in the R1 zone.
Is the intent, once we get this information, that we can decide if we want to go further, if they don't comply with that, and if it's... I'm just trying to figure out what I don't want to happen is we go out, we do a cursory look, and then you come back and say everything is fine, and then we find out that it's not. So if you're sure you can do this in a week and come back with information that we feel we can make a decision one way or the other, if it comes to that, I just want to make sure that we're not giving false hope in this situation.
What we can do is we can make sure that there is an analysis that takes place over this week and report to the council on whatever progress we've made. If we have an answer, we'll provide the answer. If we are still waiting for something, then we would inform the council of that next Monday night.
Because we still have a regularly scheduled meeting on December 15th, am I correct?
November.
I'm sorry. I'm jumping ahead of myself. I'm thinking about Christmas. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Thank you. So
I have some experience with that same situation. It's next door to where my niece is now living, and you have no control. If it's underneath, if there are less than six people there, you have absolutely no control. So. Fortunately, we've been next to them for 5 years now, and there's been absolutely no problem. They're very good neighbors. But
yeah. Well, let's find out what's out there. Let's find out how they're operating, and we can go from there.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak tonight on any item that's not on the agenda? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to council. Moving on to the consent agenda. Anybody want anything pulled? If not, may I have a motion, please?
I move move approval of items 2 and 3.
Second.
Okay. On a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Scholl, second by Councilmember Lieberman. All those in favor?
Aye.
And I need to abstain from the council meeting of the 18th. Sorry.
Okay. So. Motion passes. Moving on to regular business, item 4, amendments to a land lease agreement with Crown Castle GT Company.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor, Council members. This item is back before you for further consideration. Let's focus around the term of the actual agreement. At the last council meeting, the council approved in principle the terms of an amended lease that would run for the next 10 years. The 10-year period is shorter than what is provided for in the current agreement, which would terminate upon exercise of all the options in 2019. Crown Castle representatives and staff negotiated, and they returned with a proposal that would simply hold the terms of the agreement to the current terms, and that is that would terminate in 2019 rather than 2029, as it was proposed earlier. As point of information, Council requested, I think, three different items, and they were, first of all, the base rate that is being proposed is in the upper range of the rates that are charged for these types of facilities in this area. The ranges vary from 700 to approximately 1,600, and the base rate is going to be 1,228. The second antenna that is located in that complex is being occupied by Singular, as of the last information available to staff. And with regard to the $1 per month rent that is being provided for one of the tenants on the antenna that is in question, we were informed that that resulted, that was a result of an asset swap that took part as part of a corporate restructuring, and there is no way of increasing that at this point in time. With that, staff would recommend that the council consider and approve the proposed amendments and provide for a termination period ending in 2019. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Is there any questions of staff?
Just wanted to share some information to make sure that we're on the same page with this. The final approval for the Singular and AT&T Wireless merger was approved last week. So while our contract says Singular is the leaseholder on the second site, Singular has sold its network in California to T-Mobile. So I would think that we should be proactive and try to track down an agent, because that'll be a T-Mobile lease very soon.
Staff will pursue that lead. Thank you.
Thank you.
I had I wasn't here at the last meeting when you discussed this. So normally you have long-term leases when you try and recover large capital costs. I'm wondering, what are the capital costs that this group has put out for this antenna?
I do not have that information. It is a one antenna with a maintenance facility that's located next to it. I am not familiar.
And they've had it for how many years already?
The lease originally was entered into in
1993. My point is, why are we going into a long-term 15? Fortunately, it was 29 years. So the 2029 they wanted to. And I don't understand why we're doing this for three options. I was out on my little hand computer playing out the numbers here, and by letting them have the first 5 years at what is the middle, it's not the high end of the other examples, it's right exactly in the middle of the other leases, from 700 to 1600, 1200 is right almost in the middle. And you're giving them 5 years without any increase, and then you're going to have a 7.5% increase for the next 5 years. Rather than tying it, like everybody else rents, to a CPI cost of living increase per year. I was playing with some numbers here, and after 5 years, if you're looking at a 3% CPI average, you've lost $4,600. After 10 years, you've lost $11,600. And after the 15-year term of this, you have lost a total of $36,600. So I can see why they would like to have a long-term lease at very low fixed increases every 5 years. I don't know why we would like to see that. Unless we're thinking that perhaps the wireless industry is going to go out of business or something, which I doubt very much. I wonder why it's in our best interest to sign a lease that doesn't anywhere near cover any normal cost of living increases without any, actually with zero capital cost to them right now. They're not trying to recover anything. They're just trying to lock in a very favorable term lease.
The current lease provides for the period of time which is being proposed tonight. In other words, under the current lease, the lease, if all the options were exercised, would terminate in 2019. Mm-hmm. We were approached by that company a few months ago, basically looking to change drastically the current terms of the lease because of financial problems,
mm-hmm.
Or financial infeasibility for operating under the terms as we're being as are in place now. And I do not recall specifically how far apart the parties started and what the proposals were, but the original proposal that was brought forth by them was basically didn't provide for any increases and provided for a lower rent rate than we ultimately negotiated. What you have before you is basically a product of negotiation, and yes, there is some the change to a flat rate does compromise annual increases if we stayed with the cost of living or some kind of an index. Although we did look back and actually for the last 5 years, they were pretty close. The 7.5% was fairly reflective of the last few years. This is what was negotiated. They have been paying $1,200 a month on a $1 vendor for the last three years.
I understand they don't like the existing lease. I'm saying I don't like the new lease, and so that's the point. Why don't we just settle with a five-year lease? I don't care if it's at a no increase. That would be a wonderful lease, I would think, in any other situation. Just leave it a flat. But why do we offer 2 5-year extensions, automatic extensions, at way below market rates on something? What's in it? What's the benefit? I don't understand why we're doing this.
Well, the ultimate downside, which I don't know if is truly at risk, is that they will not renew.
Dave, I think that was part of our thinking. That's why we threw it back to them, saying we didn't want the longer lease. And I think you're in agreement with what went to staff. We weren't.
Well, thankfully, you didn't go to the year 2029.
Well, and yeah. I think the other thing we asked for extension. Were comparable rates of Aurora Grandy and the sanitation district to see what they were getting on their cell sites. And I don't see that in the staff report either. But that might have given us a better feeling for whether we were in the right place in the marketplace too.
Well, today, your report here says that today you're right in the middle of the other agreements around us, between 700 and 1,600, we're at 1,200. That doesn't say what the other long-term agreements are with these other folks. Are they going to
escalate? And that's what I'm saying. I think we were looking for more specifics. Aurora Grandy, I mean, I think there were.
This is a long-term lease at very favorable rates to another company, and I'm just saying why, with absolutely no capital.
I wish you were here when we discussed this originally. I mean, 4 years ago, when I was a candidate, this lease came forward. And as best my memory serves me, Cellular One had an existing site. And that site went away and became the taller Crown Castle site that now Cellular One is on. So I can understand what they negotiated as far as an asset exchange. But 4 years ago, I was saying with our previous city attorney as the negotiator, don't underestimate the strategic value from the bird's eye of what that site has to offer. Because not only does it light up Grover Beach looking towards Pismo, but it also enhances coverage in the Oceano area. It works both sides of the hill, which is pretty rare with our topography. So I wanted the council to be more aggressive then. And I asked Martin that very question, what's the risk of us not signing this lease? Are they going to abandon? Are three carriers going to abandon that site? Because I can think of at least two more that would want to get on it. So it's one of those things. And that's when Ron came forward with the, you know, why are we executing such a long-term lease? And that's where we got to where we were, ours, best as I can, as memory serve. But you know, I agree with you, David. It's a valuable piece of turf right there.
And I kind of think, I kind of feel like Dave says, I mean, like Steve is mentioning, we're kind of in the driver's seat. And it is a well-established site that does services not only the 101 corridor, but Highway 1 corridor, which is the other side of the street. And I don't know that we have to go out that far, 10, 15 years.
So you want to put it?
That would be my recommendation, 5 years. I don't know. I'd recommend we do 5 years, but.
I'm just listening.
Okay, that's okay. So what would you like to do?
Who was on this negotiating team? Was that the city manager and city attorney? Or is there any input you can give us out of negotiations? Your feelings on a shorter lease? Or a CPI-adjusted lease rather than a fixed rate?
I wasn't here last council meeting, so I'm not sure what kind of conversation, what the concerns, and I guess you weren't either. But what they asked to do was to lower the amount to a market rate, what they described as a more acceptable market rate. And that there would be escalators in 5-year increments in the future. So if I understand what you're talking about of limiting the term, if you limit the term, we're not going to make as much money as we would if it was the 3 periods of 5 years with escalators in the second and third 5-year period, unless we change the terms of what it is that you want to do. If you want to get a 5-year agreement with a higher number than what they're asking for and probably a lower number than what we have right now, then that may be something that we can go back and negotiate with them. They're basically saying that that it's not a competitive rate at this point. Now, you know, the geographical realities may be something different than that, and that it may be essentially the best game in town for them. And so we can certainly go back and tell them that you're not happy with what's on the table.
You know, the thing is, and I'm so glad you brought this up again, David, the issue with the Cellular One and the pain that it's causing Crown Castle, that was an asset exchange that they signed off on 4 or 5 years ago. When that larger tower went up with all the co-location. So Crown Castle generated additional revenue by subletting that taller monopole tower to other carriers. So the fact that what they negotiated with Cellular One in the past is causing them heartburn today, you know, is that something that the city of Grover Beach needs to shoulder for that, for a business decision that they're obviously regretting now? And I don't believe that's what we should be doing. I mean, the market value is what it is. I mean, what they've been paying, they're running a negative, basically. But that's market rate for a site lease. So, I just feel like 4 years later, I'm still saying we should play some hardball because it is a valuable site.
So you saying you want them to go back and negotiate more, Steve?
Yeah. Say David's not happy.
Yeah. David's pounding the table.
Show me the money.
Well, I'm just wondering, are we really saying send them back and renegotiate, or are we willing to say we like the agreement as is, without reducing the payments? I mean, if we're going to play,
that's true.
If that's our position, it's our position. I don't want to send them back, and they're still trying to figure out where we're going.
Well, we could say as is, and then if that doesn't work, then we go on to the next.
Well, I kind of feel like we're sort of at that point of, are we ready to just draw the line in the sand and say, here's what we're going to accept, and that's it, and so take it or leave it?
Well, one of the issues is that if it's a take it or leave it, then theoretically, and if they say, okay, we can't afford to stay here, I think part of what they have to factor into that cost is removing the equipment that they have there in the pole that's there, or else abandoning it to the city. And so, I mean, it seems like there would be a basis to sit down and talk to them about continuing the arrangement.
You know, this is the industry that employs me, and I don't want to be in a situation where I'm conflicted, but I do want to share information. And I can tell you that Crown Castle has sites all over the United States, and I can tell you that Crown Castle has a site that my employer is subleasing from in Cambria, and my employer is paying $2,000 a month. So... And that surprised me because I thought that was way out of market for this area. It sounded more like metropolitan Los Angeles, but Cambria's a hard place to provide coverage in, and that's what I found from our leasing agent because I was curious. So there you have it.
Well, that's why I said it might be interesting to find out what in our particular neighborhood our leasing prices, not a lot of range, because – Who's getting it for $700 and who's getting it for $1,600? And is that as a site that is not as well broadcasted as what we have, or is that just or is that typical of a site? And it sounds to me that you're telling me, Steve, that a lot of sites don't, you know, they're just broadcasting on one side of the hill and not necessarily two. And we have a site that broadcasts in a real circle, and that's really advantageous in this community or in this area. So I think that with that in mind, the $1,600, the top fee, may be more reasonable than $1,200.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I guess the biggest issue I have is I've been mulling it over since the last meeting, and it's the obviously, Crown Castle has communicated that they're in a bind financially with an agreement that they cut with another carrier. And, I mean, I come forward tonight saying that's not the fault of Grover Beach. And that's where I'm stuck.
So you think that site is worth more than a dollar a year?
I think it's at least worth $1.50.
So do we want to stick to our guns, or do we want to bring it back to... Let them research some more for next meeting?
I kind of like John's suggestion. You know, based on this and discussion and information, we're happy with the current agreement and see what they say. Does that jive with what you're saying, David?
That's a pretty hardball approach, but I certainly am not in favor of a 15-year agreement at this low of rates, every five-year increase, and then stagnant for 5 years. It's so I'd like to see either a annually CPI-adjusted lease, and I'd like to see what these other examples are, like Ron is saying. If somebody's $700 or $1,600 per month lease rates, is that $1,600 per month for the next 5 years, like our $1,200 is going to be? Or is it escalating each year, or is it a short-term lease? I don't understand any of that. I don't know any of that. And
one of the factors that was considered during negotiation is that the original rent in 1994 was $1,000 a month as the base rent.
That was with a single carrier.
That
was cellular one at that point? Slow cellular?
It was mobile, I think, at that point.
GT Mobile,
yeah. And the current lease, which... again, by its terms, would terminate in 2019, provides for a increase is based upon, I think it's a one of the indexes. So in 10 years, that amount has been raised to $1,228. So $228 over the last 10 years. So that's just a little bit more than a 7.5%. Not a great disparity.
That's a contract. That's not just a number that they pulled out of a hat.
No, that's the existing
rental rate.
Right.
And they want to maintain that for the next 5 years.
Right.
And I'm wondering why we'd even do that.
Because I think their original proposal was talking about going back down to a single rate and not paying for the additional carriers for a period. I believe it was originally set for 10 years.
Oh, again, what is the current rate right now, Martin?
$1,228 and 20 cents per month.
Right there. Okay.
That's a base rate. Then additionally, they're paying for the additional two carriers, they're paying the same amount again twice. So the city is currently receiving approximately $3,600 a month from them.
So what do you guys want to do? You want to leave it as is?
Well, I'd like I don't know how to form a motion to give this kind of direction with consensus, but I'd like staff to go back and now that we have a full council discussing this, kind of share the concerns that have arisen. I mean, I think David's is a valid concern. I'm going back to the slow cellular lease, saying that's not our concern as the city of Grover Beach, that business arrangement, and why should we be impacted because of that? And then whatever else has been risen, you know, has
been
brought
up. Ron wanted the information from surrounding, so we can get that information.
We can attempt to get that. One of the issues that would control that, and that's why we don't have specific information right now, is that each site is really very different, as Councilmember Lieberman identified. And the numbers just are a very wide range. So unless we know exactly what type of a broadcast range, what kind of a location, it is difficult to compare numbers, but we can bring those numbers to you.
I think there's a handful of, you want an obviously co-located sites, so multiple carriers on a single pole, and I can think of three or four in the county. Crown Castle has one in Atascadero at Michael Frederick Paving on their property. The city of Arroyo Grande has a co-located site on a water tank. There's private property on South 4th Street, a storage yard that has a co-located pole on it as well. That would be actually in Oceano. That's three. I know there's more.
How about the sanitation district?
I'm not even familiar. I haven't seen the structures there.
Pretty sure we have cell sites there.
Up on the tanks.
Mm-hmm.
But there's at least three that have similar number of carriers on poles. I know Crown Castle has at least the Atascadero location.
I'm still not certain as to the specific direction.
I'm hearing that we're saying that we like the existing contract better than this new offer. Is that fair to say?
Yes, but I think we also want to...
And go back and negotiate. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I was kind of hearing the same thing from the majority, and that's why I was asking that question, because you know, I do want to thank staff for the negotiation, and I can kind of see where we're talking about the automatic extensions every 5 years and the 7.5% increase. I mean, I could certainly support that, but I mean, if this council majority is saying, why should them taking over Cellular One at $1 per month be our issue, then I think it gets us back to, well, if we're happy with where we are, then I think we need to stay.
And I'm okay with the hybrid of this discussion. I mean, if they come back and present, I mean, to me, they need to present more of a business case. And if the business case says, you're right, it's not your fault with the slow cellular piece that we're asking for you to help us with that financial burden, that's not your fault, we're going to adjust for that accordingly. I'm open to 5-year renewable terms. As far as your question about capital, Yeah, the Capitol was spent a long time ago. It was spent 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's a building and a pole. So,
I want to make one little statement too. We've got a 10-year record on, track record on this particular site. I think that we'd all be in agreement. First of all, I think we're in agreement that we like our contract. We don't really want to change it because it's advantageous to our city. The only drawback there is that if it's so advantageous to a local business or group of businesses that we're being unfair, that's where the marketplace that I've asked for would kind of give us an indication of whether we're being unfair to these people because our cell site is too expensive in that marketplace. Then I think at that point we may say, hey, you know, you're right. We are over – we're way over what the marketplace is trying to what the marketplace is. And we agree. Let's trim back the contract either – financially, or try to look at it on a more on a shorter term, so that we are compensated fairly and you're compensated fairly. I think there's some other issues that I was going to bring up in council communication, that some of the fees that we just went through and raised. There are some people out there that are now, our fees have changed so much in Grover through the enactment of the new fees, that we're starting to penalize our local business people, and they're thinking about going to Arroyo Grande in certain instances. Now, is that really what we want? We surely want to compensate the city and make sure that we are compensated for the product that we provide, but we don't necessarily want to run business out of our community. So I think it's a double-edged sword, and it's a fine line to walk.
Ron, I agree with you, but I think it's something else to consider is, I think for the longest time, is Grover Beach hasn't done a good job of recovering its costs. And, you know, we keep talking about the city's changing and we're raising the bar on expectations and you know, we want to make people that want to do business in Grover Beach make it a smoother process. Well, there's costs that we need to recover to do that. I just think that Grover's laid dormant for a long time without increasing fees, so now it looks like a real dramatic jump.
Yeah, well, the only thing I'm saying is if someone in another community, Arroyo Grande or Pismo Beach, is charging $100 for the same service, we need to either say, hey, and we're charging $300 or $400, we need to look real seriously at how we got to that figure, mm-hmm. or we need to evaluate, we need to go to a Pismo and Arroyo Grande and say, hey, you know, we're charging this much. Do you guys think that you might look at your fees?
Right.
Because it is advantageous to the whole business community, to the whole the cities, to be somewhat in sync with fees, because it is you know, there's not a very long far distance to go before you get into Rio Grande or Pismo, and if, as a business person, if I can move over there and save myself a lot of fees, people do that, and I think we don't really want to run off people that have been here 10 or 15 years and established good businesses. And I think we need to look at that on our fees also.
Okay.
Okay, now we still haven't gotten to one.
I think we did.
Do you have direction?
Well, as I understand the direction, the council wants staff to respond by stating that the current agreement is the available option to Crown Castle.
Well, after further discussion, we feel that it best represents the community of Grover Beach. And if they want to provide additional information to justify their case, I think we're willing to entertain that.
And this would be in nature of supporting documentation for their agreement on the asset swap, explaining why their rent is so low on one item?
Or if they're comfortable with that, or what are they paying to other communities for co-located sites in San Luis Obispo County?
Right. Okay.
So now are we looking for something in writing, or can they shouldn't it? I'm just curious. The last time I asked, they didn't have any representatives here. I mean, if this is important enough for them.
I agree, John. Think that they would have someone that would fill in the blanks for us at the podium at this point.
Like where our staff wouldn't have to be in the middle.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to talk about a shorter term lease, too. See, why? What's wrong with a 5-year lease? Why do they need a 15 or 25-year lease on a site?
Did if the current direction is to remain with the existing lease, and if they choose to exercise the next option, that gives them another 5 years, and then 5 years after that.
My point
is actually through 2019.
Right.
So they have 15 years remaining on the current lease. So if it's the council's preference that we move forward with a counter that says it's the current lease, should they accept it, we do have a 15-year agreement.
No.
Yeah. Thanks for explaining that, Martin. Okay.
And I'm trying to say that I wouldn't object to changing the lease if they want to come in with a shorter term lease. And that was part of the negotiations. So if they wanted to come in with a shorter term lease starting at 12/23 and having an annual CPI that is adjusted upwards.
We can certainly put that on the table. But if the starting point is to say that the council is more comfortable with the current agreement, then that would be kind of confusing to say the current agreement, but only for 5 years. And I guess the part that I'm confused about is why would you want to limit the term to 5 years? What would be better 5 years from now for the city to not have the 15-year, particularly if you've got if it's based on some kind of a CPI?
Well, that was my point. If you wanted to have a 15-year lease at an annual CPI-adjusted rate, that equals $36,000 more over the 19 years than the existing rate. They're offering us a really low-ball, long-term lease agreement that I don't think is in our best interest. And so I'm saying if they wanted to offer something else that was shorter term, fine. Otherwise, we'll just keep what we've got.
Okay.
Shorter term or
shorter term
CPI
with
for an annual increase. In other words, if the council wishes us to go back and say the terms are fine with the exception of a 7.5% increase every 5 years, instead of that, we would propose some CPI or some number that we arrive at that's equivalent to that, I don't know, 2% a year or 2.2% a year. If that's the counter that the council would like the staff to carry back to them, then I want to establish what the direction is with certainty. So when we go back to the negotiating table or a non-negotiating table, we know what the direction from council is.
What do you guys want to do? Because we're getting two signals.
When you're doing your CPI calculation, were you?
Well, I'm thinking Mr. Ekbaum needs to formulate a motion since he's got a lot of energy on this.
This is first 5 years. $12.50.
I agree with John. Go ahead, Dave. Put together a motion, and I think we'd support it.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to make a motion that we go back to the original agreement and say that we do like the original agreement better than the proposed agreement. If that is not acceptable to them, we would be responsive to some kind of a shorter term lease with annual CPI adjusted increases. Shorter term of 5 or 10 years. So that at the end of 5 years, if we don't like it, we can say, this is too low. Everything has jumped out of the site, but tying us into a 15 or 25-year lease is way too long. And my problem with this isn't any kind of a lease that you would rent a building for. I guess I'm making a motion and rambling at the same time. I'm sorry.
It's a rambling motion.
Ramble on.
Okay, no. I guess that was my motion. Is that significant?
Do you understand that, Martin?
Sufficient.
I understand it, but the second proposal would be less advantageous to them than the first one.
Possibly.
Okay.
They're saying they cannot live with this proposal as written now that they're in. That's why they're here. Isn't that the truth? They're saying this is really hurting us. We're paying $12.50 for a site that we we receive $1 for.
The current agreement, again, provides for, I believe, I don't remember what index it's on, but it's gained us roughly around 20% over the last 10 years in increases on the base rent. So we're going to propose to them that they either accept the current agreement as is, which means that they have another 15 years under the current terms, or as an option, negotiate a shorter term agreement, a 5-year or a 10-year agreement, with an index rate that is the same, that is lower. I just want to make sure I understand the specific direction.
I think Dave's saying lower. CPI is lower than what they've been doing. I mean, the cost of living is, isn't it?
I mean, I think CPI is going to be much higher than their.
Think so?
They're certainly than their proposed one.
Yeah.
7.5%
but less than what they're paying right now.
In arrears is shoot, that must be 1% a year increase.
But Dave, you're comfortable if they come back with the CPI, but they want 10 years with a renewable 5? I mean, you're open to whatever their counter is?
I'm open to a counter. Let's look at it. Just if you're going to rent a commercial building or any other kind of business transaction, well, this seems like it should be, it certainly would be in these kind of terms, I wouldn't think. It's too far out there, it's too many unknowns, and too low of a base increase. So.
Okay, so you made a motion. Was there a second?
Is staff clear on the motion?
Yes.
I'll second it.
Yeah, I was going to second it to move it forward. But okay.
Could we have a roll call, please?
Yes.
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 Yes. Okay, moving on. Public hearings. Item 5, first reading of a zoning ordinance text amendment relating to the installation of curb gutter sidewalk improvements.
Mayor, members of the council, Jake Raper, Community Development Director for the City of Grover Beach. The proposed, just sort of some background on where we came from and where we're at. On August 2nd, the City Council directed staff to make recommendations to initiate an amendment to our zoning ordinance to modify the methodology used to trigger infrastructure improvements. And at that time, we were talking about curb gutter sidewalk, the undergrounding of utility lines, and also in retrospect and in coordination with the fire sprinkling ordinance that was recently adopted. On August 16th, the City Council adopted a resolution initiating the ordinance amendment, which is resolution number 0464. On October 4th, the City Council received a report titled Potential Approaches to Revitalize Our Community, which presented some different scenarios and alternatives to the City Council. At the conclusion of that meeting, the City Council directed us to come back with a ordinance amendment to change the methodology using the square footage relationship between the new improvements and the existing improvements of the structure that would trigger the infrastructure improvements. As the City Council does recall that we utilized a 40% increase in floor area to trigger the installation of improvements. In this case, under item number 5 of this public hearing, it specifically talks about the installation of curb gutter and sidewalk. What we have proposed to you is a series of ordinance amendments to our existing ordinance that talks about when curb gutter and sidewalk would be installed. In addition, we've expanded the ordinance to discuss what we call street conform, and that is the required installation of street improvements from the lip of the new curb and gutter to the street. And normally, a street conform could involve a travel lane plus 8 feet to match up a required engineered street conform. As part of the staff report in trying to develop a ordinance that would be easily implemented and administered by staff as well as the general public, we're using a multiplier of effect for the various kinds of square footage added to the proposed or the existing structure. For example, in residential buildings, we use a multiplier of one for gross living space. For garages and accessory structures, we use a multiplier of 0.25, and for patios and other open structures, we use a multiplier of 0.15. Could you put this up for me? Where we get these multipliers, it's really a dollar relationship between the ICBO, which is the International Congress of Building Officials, value for various types of building improvements. As part of the staff report, we've identified what that relationship is between gross living space, garages, and patios to come up with the approximate multiplier associated with that calculation. As part of the staff report, any kind of ordinance amendment requires an environmental review. As for the record, what we wanted to do is identify that this type of ordinance amendment is exempt per section 1506B1 because there's absolutely, and we can say with certainty, there's no significant potential impacts to the environment that would result from this action. Looking at specifically the illustrations that we're utilizing for curb, gutter, and sidewalks, what we have done as part of the ordinance amendment, we've utilized a lot of graphics and as part of the utilization and implementation of the ordinance. And what we're trying to show in the upper portion of the graphic is the existing improvements of 1,000 square foot of gross living area, 400 square foot garage, a patio area of 100 square feet, and a workshop of 300 square feet. And what we have actually calculated out is using the multiplier based on the proposed ordinance to come up with the existing square footage of all the improvements. The lower portion of the illustration identifies when a patio is taken away and we're adding 500 square foot of living area. And through the calculations shown on the illustrations is that we're adding a 500 square foot area times one, which is the multiplier for gross living area, and coming up with 500 square feet. Then what we're doing is giving credit for the patio removed of 100 square feet times the 0.15, which is 15 square feet. And the net total gross living area identified is 485 square feet. Then when we do the percentage calculation for the new addition and the existing structure, we come up with 40.8%, which would require the installation of curb, gutter, and sidewalk. The second example, there you go, is the same method. And we use the same graphics throughout where everyone could become familiar with the graphics and utilizing it. The only difference at this point is where they're adding a 450 square foot gross living area, the bottom portion. The upper portion is exactly the same square footage. It's the patio, the garage, the workshop, and the living gross living area. And instead of using a 500 square foot addition, we're adding 450 square feet. And again, we do the calculations for the proposed addition, giving credit for the 15 square feet of the patio that is removed, coming up with a total gross floor area of 435 square foot that's added. And when we do the percentage calculation, it comes up to 36.6%, which does not require the installation of curb, gutter, and sidewalk. So for all commercial and industrial developments, we only use a multiplier of one, if we could use that. Top. In the multiple family, commercial, and industrial type of example, what we're using is a 1,000 square foot building, a 400 square foot area, and a workshop of 300 square feet. And we're using a multiplier of one for all those square footages. And we're coming up with 1,700 square feet that would be existing. If you go to the lower portion of the illustration, They would be adding 700 square feet to the existing structure, which would be 41% calculation, and therefore they would be required to install curb, gutter, and sidewalk. This one. The next example shows where they would not be required to add curb, gutter, and sidewalk, and looking at the lower portion, they'd be adding 650 square feet. And doing the percentage calculation, they would come up with 38.2%, and therefore they would not be required to install curb, gutter, and sidewalk. So that's the methodology we use to show the when they would and would not be required to provide for or install and design curb, gutter, and sidewalk. What we attempted to do in the ordinance as well is to identify that the street conform is an integral part of the curb, gutter, sidewalk installation. And we added a section of the ordinance which tries to explain to what degree and when the street conform would be required. We also identifying as part of the ordinance that our current requirement is that the city engineer does the curb, gutter, sidewalk design in terms of horizontal and vertical alignment. And then from there, the street conform would be designed, meeting the engineering requirements as established by this ordinance. That in itself is the proposed amendments to the ordinance. And if the city council has any questions, we'll be happy to respond to what your questions may be.
Is there any questions to staff? Councilmember Arnoldson.
I don't think I have a question. I have some discussion later, but okay. I'm okay.
Councilmember Lieberman.
Jake, the street conform issue, I'm very sensitive to that.
Yes.
And given a recent event in Grover Beach, I mean, this policy leads me to believe that in some cases the resident may be responsible to go over 50% of the width of the street to make the conform to their curb, gutter, and sidewalk, based on what I saw recently. Is that accurate?
In some cases, in some extreme cases, it could include the entire travel lane plus 8 feet to get the appropriate slopes to come up with the engineering design criteria, and that could possibly be.
Okay. That's all I have for right now. I'll have more after the public hearing.
Can I chime in on that, Steve? That's what my discussion was going to be. The other part of that is not only do they have to go to the middle of the street and pass sometimes to make a street conform, many times some people have to build the street out on both sides of their property so that people adjacent to them don't get flooded. And that's a pretty tough thing to swallow, too, if you're in the middle of a block and you have to build out the street on both sides of your house and just as a temporary measure that's going to be torn up somewhere in the future too. So I think that we need to come up with some kind of an average plan that fits everyone. And I don't know if we can do that with an ordinance or if there's a way that the city council can set aside funds that kind of are triggered out of street repair funds when something like this is an anomaly. Not the normal thing, but the anomaly where I have a house that's in the middle of the block and have to be built in the middle of the street or pass, plus I have to protect both my neighbors. And I don't know if that's fair to someone just because they decided to repair their, to expand their living area. So that's part of what I'd like to talk about. I mean, get some discussion going on.
Councilmember Ekbom.
Well, I'll buy in on this one. Who would build more than 39.9% of a building if they had to engineer the street besides build it out to a lane plus the 8 feet plus put in your curb, gutter, and sidewalk? Everybody will zero in on anything under the 40% requirement. I mean, that would be automatic, I would think. And I'm surprised that that jumped in here because what we were trying to make it a little easier to encourage remodeling, and all of a sudden we've said, well, you don't have to put in your curb, gutter, and sidewalk if you go under 40%, but if you do, now you're going to build out the street too, and engineer it. I was surprised at all that.
The current requirement is that they do the street conform. And as we've had some recent experiences with that in terms of timing and communication and working out an agreement with some specific homeowners.
We all know in the northwest section over there that that one. I mean,
well, there's a gentleman on the corner of 13th and Newport, or the second house west of 13th and Newport, that battled with this not too long ago either. He tore down a substantial home and put in a
modular.
I guess they're modulars. And I don't think he was aware of what he was going to have to do until he was trying to get his final. And then it was like, well, no, you got to go down there another half a block with asphalt, or we're not going to final your home. And
yes, he had to do some tapers in and tapers out to control the flood.
Yeah. And the water. Yeah, and when it's temporarily and when it's not to provide service to your next door neighbor, it's pretty hard to swallow.
Good. So I have heartburn on that also. But I have two other things while I'm talking. One of them was patios. Are you talking about covered patios? Are you talking about a gravel section that we call a patio or a cement slab? What is a patio?
It'd be an open structure. That's basically, if it's
open
flat
structure.
Work, like a patio, a gazebo, or one of those.
Overhead structure at
so
all?
So it is covered.
Yes.
Covered patio.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not
and
just flat work. I mean, just concrete or patio stepping stones and that type of thing.
That is not. Okay.
Yeah.
Why are we including the accessory buildings in the measurements, the workshop or whatever? Why is that?
Because it's part of the total the valuation that we currently do. And so what we're trying to do is do a comprehensive application to make sure that the accessory structures as well as the gross living area are incorporated as part of the comprehensive review and administration. Now, we currently do that with the existing valuation. If they add all these items to their home, we calculate it based upon the ICBO valuation currently. And so as a continuation of existing practice. And but what we're doing is taking out the dollar value and using the multiplier effect.
But just looking at your examples, I understand them. I think it's very clear, and I think it's easy for people to zero in on. But it actually increases the amount of square footage you can add to your home and still be under it with an accessory building. And I don't see where they fit neat. If you're going to take the living space of your home and your garage and maybe a covered patio and increase it, I don't know how you should be able to count your tool shed or your storage locker in the back or whatever other accessory buildings you might have. If there's, I'm just surprised that that's there, and I would.
And again, the reason that it's there is because we use that valuation methodology under the current implementation of the ordinance way it exists today.
But we're proposing changes.
No, the only change we're making is changing it from a dollar valuation to a multiplier. And the way we come up with the comparative multipliers is based upon the ICBO dollar valuation for these types of structures.
We're changing the valuation amounts, but we're also changing the percentage before we kick in the curb, gutter, and sidewalk. We're making changes to the ordinance, and so I think it's a time to talk about other changes.
Yeah, if you wish to incorporate. I guess my main point to the council is this is the method that we use for the dollar valuation. We've carried it over to the multiplier factor. And so if we want to change the current method that we're doing and modifying it with the multiplier factor that we're proposing, then now would be the time to do that.
No, that's my reason for bringing it up.
Yes.
I would think that wouldn't make sense why it's included. So.
Can I say something about why it may make sense
to
me? Because you're increasing the square footage of your lot coverage, and by increasing lot coverage, you're shedding more water. By shedding more water, you need to find a place for that water to go, and curb gutter and sidewalk is a way to to channel that water. Another way to channel that water is the Sullivan slumps we've used in the past. So I think this also makes sense in that realm where when you go from a building that's 1,000 square feet and you build 2,000 square feet, you have another 1,000 square feet of hard surface that's going to shed water, and it needs to go someplace. And the way to channel it is curb, gutter, and sidewalk.
Somehow I got I was talking about the workshop accessory buildings being counted in the total computation there. I don't think it's necessary. But
I think we should clarify that what we're talking about are buildings that are built with a concrete foundation and stud walls and real roofs and not something you go down to
minor. So that's not three of the Sears
no.
5x9 buildings you're going to add up and say these are also in the works because they're my.
Right. Okay. Buildings that have electricity in them and.
No. Okay. Buildings that require building permits.
Okay.
And structures that require building permits.
Well, that certainly narrows the list. I'm still not quite sure why that would be involved in the expansion of a home. What we're trying to do was to say, folks, you can go on and add a bedroom and a bath to your house without kicking in all these other improvements. And we're muddying up the water somehow, I guess, too. But, okay, I've said no.
Is that all your questions,
yes,
Dave?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Schultz.
Yeah, I've been trying to just wait until the comment period comes, but I just wanted to maybe make one statement that may help Dave. This methodology gives the living area a value of one, and it also acknowledges the existing structures and gives them a factor based on building code value through ICBO. This actually would be advantageous to someone who actually owned a 1,000-square-foot home and had a detached accessory structure as opposed to just looking at that 1,000 square feet and applying the number right to it. So I think it's actually a little more generous. I didn't really have a question more so than we passed this area already, and we were up here talking about street conformed and trying to be cognizant of the folks who are in the audience and the folks who are at home who are listening to the issue of street conform. Could you provide a clarification so people will understand when you're saying street conform what in fact you're talking about, please?
Well, in essence, when you install new curb and gutter, the street conform is the asphalt insulation from the lip of the gutter at a certain percentage slope to the center of the street and possibly past the street, one travel lane. And what we had the city engineer write the definition for us, and if I may just read it for
the
council and the audience. And this is all new language in the proposed ordinance. Street conform, as required by Section 91379A, which says that you install curb, gutter, and sidewalk as well as street conform, the applicant or property owner shall install a street conform when a new or replacement of curb, gutter, and sidewalk is required. The street conform shall be designed by the city engineer at the property owner's expense. The street conform may be extensive dependent upon existing street condition and the existing street's horizontal and vertical alignment versus the city's engineer design for the horizontal and vertical alignment. Street conforms may be required to be installed on both sides of the streets abutting corner lots. A street conform is that portion of new street built between the curb and gutter lip of the new gutter that meets or conforms to existing paving in a safe manner. The resulting slope between the new gutter and the existing street at the conform point is called the crossfall. A maximum safe crossfall shall not exceed 10%, and a usual crossfall will range from a 2% to a 5% as approved by the city engineer. Now, when we had some dialogue in terms of the vertical and horizontal alignment and the danger of not installing vertical and horizontal alignment for curb and gutter and the street conform is that if you have rolling slopes as we do, in order to make sure that the flow of the water that goes along the curb and gutter in a vertical and horizontal standpoint is that you want the the water flow to flow downhill, as well as the street to flow to at a slope that is not so dramatic, that creates a vertical misalignment, which means up and down, and the horizontal alignment, which means sideways. So the theory is that the water flow will come at a gentle slope, not to exceed 10%, hit the curb and gutter, and then flow in a safe manner without going over the curb and onto the property. And that was one of the design concerns that the city engineer provided to us.
Yeah, and I just quickly for the folks in the audience and at home, the simple answer is street conform is that portion of the new street built between the curb and gutter lip of the new gutter that meets or conforms to existing paving in a safe manner.
Right.
And the width of that conform will vary depending on the slope and the condition of the street.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions? Steve? No. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on this item? It is a public hearing.
They're all asleep.
If not, we'll close the public hearing, bring it back to council. Who wants to be first?
I'll go first. I believe I'm okay with the methodology for residential structures. I think the direction was, in fact, to increase the threshold or the trigger mechanism to allow folks to improve their or remodel existing homes, and I think this will allow them to have a modest addition before we kick any of these costly frontage improvements in effect. And I can just tell you that, Chief, we need to make a distinction, because at least where I'm at is these changes are for residential, for existing homes in older neighborhoods. And then finally, I think Councilman Lieberman and Arneson touched on this, the street conform. And I know that Councilman Arneson and I had talked about with the street conform, there's two things I believe that need to occur. An existing situation in which, to meet the slope, an individual was told that he would probably have to pave out to the center line of the street. To me, that's excessive, especially when it's a structurally sound street. So I don't know if we need to come up with a policy that says it needs to be 2 feet or 4 feet from the new gutter. And then the second thing is, do we need to come up with a fund if it means a portion of the street rehabilitation monies, so that there is funds available so staff can be able to respond to situations like we dealt with recently on Saratoga without having to come back to the council. So I want to put those out there for us to kind of discuss this evening.
David?
Well, I'm listening to John there, and I'm agreeing with him, mainly in the fact that we're trying to encourage remodels to upgrade, but we also want to encourage sidewalks. And the more we pile on there with huge street conform, we're just going to have them build underneath the trigger amount. I mean, it's a natural thing. You can save curb gutter and sidewalk. You could save easily $10,000 or $15,000 on a project by maybe not quite adding 600 square feet, maybe adding 550 square feet. I think we're defeating our own purpose there. We want to encourage remodels. And if we want to encourage curb gutter and sidewalk, but not force people to choose between remodel or curb gutter and sidewalk. And so I agree. I hope there is some compromise that we can work on with this street conform issue. But other than that, I think we're on the right track here.
Councilmember Lieberman.
Thanks. I, too, agree with the issues that everyone's raised so far. The big one for me is street conforms, and it's exactly for the reason David mentioned. This council, when we talked about the trigger, we agreed to lessen the burden on someone by doing other things, but we all sat here and said that sidewalks are a safety issue in the city of Grover Beach. So we definitely want to encourage folks to put in curb gutter and sidewalk. I don't want to burden them with a street conform that's going to go more than halfway across the street. I think we need to stick to, John had mentioned a couple of distances. I think we need to find something in the city. We design those streets. We rehab those streets. And I don't think it's fair to penalize someone when we're asking them to put in curb gutter and sidewalk for a safety issue. So I think we need to deal with the street conform issue big time. That wasn't part of what I was expecting to see with this. I'm glad that was brought forward because I wouldn't have thought of it again otherwise. Mm-hmm. But and I appreciate staff putting it in here, but I just think we need to ease the burden. I mean, that was the intent of all of these triggers, and that's all I have right now.
Thank you.
Well, we do try to be comprehensive.
Councilmember Arnoldson.
Oh, I'm pretty much in agreement with everything that Councilman Schultz said a minute ago, and I would hope that we come up with some methodology to solve this.
Grade that the city engineer would want it to be if folks go out 2 feet in order to set up their forms and build the curb gutter and sidewalk and come back and pave that minor transition, that's something that the council is comfortable with the applicant doing. And then beyond that, if it's a major kind of reconstruction, that would be something that the city is doing. If that's the kind of direction you want to give us, we can certainly incorporate that into a revised proposed ordinance amendment. There is clearly that would then be something that I guess would then rise to the top of our list of annual local street paving kinds of projects to say the first thing we would do is we would be dealing with the conforms, and then we would deal with the systematic approach to addressing local street improvements. But that's clearly a policy direction that you can give us, and we'd be happy to modify the proposed ordinance amendment.
I think it's true, because I think so many times, as John was saying, as they walk the streets and so forth, you know, people out there don't feel like they have to buy the street just because they want to put the curb gutter sidewalk in. And it is something that the whole city uses, and they don't feel that they should have to be responsible for the whole street. So,
but our city manager is bringing up a big point. Mm-hmm. That individual development somewhere on some side street requires us to go there and repair that street. They're dictating where we spend our street repair money, because they put in a development, curb gutter sidewalk, paved out 3 or 4 feet, whatever we decide is their right, their obligation, and then we have to go in and design and complete the rest of the project in a timely fashion. Otherwise, you've got a real irregular spot there. And so they're forcing us to spend city street money at their location. That might not be our top priority, but by their development, they've forced us to.
I think that's in the bigger developments, like the one over here that was on Rockaway.
No, it could be any single home on any single side street.
If you have a home that has a vertical alignment issue, and we put the curb gutter and curb and gutter where it's supposed to be for the proper vertical alignment, if all of a sudden that vertical alignment is below the existing street and they pave out, say, 2 feet or 4 feet or whatever without sloping that up, you're going to have more of a dramatic beyond a 10% slope. And that could create some safety issues as well as potential overflow of the curb with when stormwater comes by.
We have that over here.
I go back to the argument that we designed those streets and we poured those streets and people bought the homes on those streets. They're doing an improvement that they want to do to their homes and increase their property value. They're putting in curb gutter and sidewalk because we've made a trigger that's easier for them to stomach between the other conditions that we haven't discussed yet. We want them to put in curb gutter and sidewalk because we've all said we feel better.
We've had to pave out to the center line in order to meet the slope.
It probably wouldn't be difficult. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
So,
if I could, one of the reasons why you guys wanted us to come up with this new policy is because you wanted to be able to encourage neighborhood revitalization. And if folks have looked into the issue in the past and figured out, oh, I'd have to do a street conform, which is the current policy and has been for a number of years, then they may have already decided not to do it. So the kind of research you're asking us to do is a good idea, but it may not tell us what you're really looking for. That's folks have already been discouraged in the past.
That's a good point.
I have an idea. It may be a stupid idea, and it might be a brilliant idea, but one thing that we might look at is that if someone does have a major street conform like that, we have them go ahead and do it at their cost, but we take back a certain amount of fees, which is a win-win for everybody because they can probably do the street conform a lot less expensively than the city can if the city went in there with prevailing wage and did the street conform. However, we, you know, like I said, we take away a part of their fees, and I think we win in both realms, if that's possible. So I don't know if that's another way to look at this, Jake, or lower their fees. We don't take them away. I mean, we say, okay, you get credit for this street conform against ABC, whatever it is, you know, the.
Yeah, the there's several different ways you could do it. One is that if it kicks in curb, gutter, and sidewalk, is basically you require them to pay the design, and you require them to deposit what the current value of the curb, gutter, and sidewalk is. And once we get to rehab that street, or get a number of street projects going in, we go in and do the curb, gutter, sidewalk, and street conform under one contract. If you want to require them to do the curb, gutter, and sidewalk and 2 foot of street conform, then what we may want to do is defer the installation of the curb, gutter, sidewalk until such time as we can do the pave out. Or your suggestion is require them to put it in and ask them to submit for a reimbursement out of the street paving fund. Mm-hmm. And that way we don't have this lag time between them doing it and the city getting around and hiring a contractor to go out and doing it. I would prefer the latter part because they would contract with the person doing the curb gutter sidewalk. They would contract to have the street conform put in. And if the city council has a policy decision wishes to refund them or repay them for that work on behalf of the city, that could be a policy direction as well. But again, that will take away from your local street rehab monies.
Well, the advantage of I see of doing it that way, getting a refund or a credit or something like that, is that I think it's some of the people that I talked to, they were talking about in this teens or $20,000 to do a rehab, which is there's no way we could do a rehab in front of one house for that much money. It would be a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000
even done. Still.
Yes. Yeah.
Close.
The city ended up having to make up the difference in the increases that mm-hmm. occurred over time. The deposit was given to us. The deposit plus interest didn't cover the real cost of it. So that's one issue that can occur. And it can go the other way. The deposit plus interest could be more than what it really costs when we get around to doing it. The second thing is that if you have them do the conform and then pay them public funds to reimburse them for that, then you triggered prevailing wage. So you don't avoid it.
Well, the only thing I'm saying is not necessarily pay them back, but giving them a credit on the fees that we charge, the development fee, the fee for fire, police, whatever it is, you give them some kind of a credit.
Martin.
And 13th and Highland is done. It's beautiful. It looks great.
Mm-hmm. Even with a credit, again, that would be expenditure of public money for a project. One of the options that the council may consider, and Jake and I have not talked about this, but you simply may, and I am not aware of how many, what's the percentage of instances where such a situation would create an undue hardship, but simply putting in a provision in the ordinance that in the event that the street conform creates an undue hardship, it's subject to review by community development director and or appeal to the council. And this way you can have situations where on an individual basis people can come before you and say, this requirement is, you know, putting me over the edge with regard to the project, or having the community development department make that determination initially.
You don't feel you'd open a can of worms on that?
Yeah, everybody's going to say I have a hardship.
Mm-hmm. What I was contemplating, at least, or proposing, would be a situation where, in fact, it was not a everyday pave out mm-hmm. to conform, the street conform, where it was a situation where you have to go either to center line or into the next traveling lane, or as Councilmember Arnoldson described, where you have to pave out large portions of street surface in front of other people's property. But a regular street conform would not qualify for the hardship under those circumstances.
Mm. If I can jump in, I think that's a great suggestion. And I'm going to be making a motion here very shortly. The other thing I wanted to clarify is when I was talking about creating a fund in which we took, let's say, a percentage of our street rehabilitation monies, I think we will have segments of streets in our capital improvement in the CIP. What I'm thinking is creating a fund that's outside of that in which staff can be able to respond to these items. And so if we're contributing $50,000 per quarter or whatnot, those are the monies that are used. And once we get to the end of that, those funds, then obviously the individuals will have to contribute, and we'll have to figure out a way of how we fix that gap. But that way, it wouldn't have to be stuck into the CIP. And I think that's what I'm thinking. I'm not thinking of this taking precedence over the street segments that we've adopted that are in that plan for 5 years out.
And that's an excellent
thinking on that. But with that said, I move that we...
Can I ask one question before you do that?
Sure.
When we're talking about hardships, is there any way that hardship portion could be set aside in CDBG money? Is that another avenue for if someone could show that the hardship was extreme enough that CDBG money would be an applicable place
to... It has to be primarily benefiting low and moderate income and... dealing with national goals of eliminating blight or economic development or housing.
Well, and it probably does all those. That's why I'm asking, I would think.
Unfortunately, street works like that would be very hard to show a benefit to the targeted income group and meeting the national objectives. Paving streets is not a qualified project under the CDBG.
Well, it's the addition of a new home, addition on your home. You're building more square footage on your home. That triggers a street improvement. But if that street improvement compromises the finances you have to build your home, isn't that a similar argument? I mean, it's like you can't build a home because you have to fix a street. Now, that doesn't make sense to me.
If the council wishes me to investigate it, I will, but I believe it would not qualify as funds expended under CDBG. Okay.
Sorry, John.
That's okay.
Okay. John, you make a motion?
Yeah, I was thinking I'd like to move that we direct staff to... I guess I'm thinking I want to continue this to a date, move that we continue this to a date certain. I'm thinking November 15th maybe, and once I give the direction, maybe staff can tell me if that is actually a doable date. I believe the direction should be that we require all commercial, industrial, and multifamily projects install sidewalk, curb, and gutter, because I believe the intent originally was that it just be residential.
Any addition?
I'd also like to see us add a clause that would allow the council to grant exceptions in situations to where someone can prove there's an undue hardship with respect to paving out the street conform. And if we need to clarify further what that might be, I would say that means if someone's having to pave out to center line, and I don't know, maybe you guys can chime in here. We can figure out if it's centerline or beyond 4 feet. And then, finally, I'd like to give some direction regarding a policy with respect to establishing a special fund or street enhancement fund that would allow staff to respond in situations where a street conform issue comes up and it isn't a major situation. So I know that's not very clear. I'm working through this one.
Is that where exceptions are granted?
You know what? Maybe that's – I tell you what, I'm going
to have a right to appeal to the council.
I think that's better process-wise. So, yeah, I would amend my motion.
I have a question. John, your motion is to do it with this methodology, right?
Yes, I like the methodology with respect to
– Oh, it's second the motion.
Remodels, yes. And I'm actually looking to see that figure three, which is the one regarding commercial industrial, would go away.
Is there any discussion?
Mayor, under the existing section of the code under C on page 9 of your staff report, the City Council already has the ability to waive any portion of this ordinance where there's create substantial hardships that or would be impractical or would not be in the best interest of the city or the public to waive the requirement. And under C5, it says each request for waiver of the requirements of the section shall be acted upon independently by a council based upon the particular facts involved. So you have that.
So we do have that.
You have the exception capability now.
Just as a point of discussion, what if we set a minimum standard for the conform? You know, you, homeowner, are responsible for the first 18 inches, 2 feet, 4 feet.
4 feet.
Anything above that, I mean, 4 feet, David's saying. And basically, that's not open to discussion. So that's your responsibility. If it's anything beyond that, then we would consider the hardship case. I mean, I just feel like we need to set a limit.
If that's okay with you, because I would amend my motion to – actually, I guess I need to amend my motion to say that undue hardship is anything beyond the 4 feet. Is that
– 4 foot average?
The 4 –
Well, because we do have, you know, tapers and – because some areas may go out 6 feet and go down to 1 foot.
Okay.
I mean
– 4 foot average.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion?
I'm full agreement that there's some way we need to zero in on what is a hardship. Otherwise, everyone will mm-hmm. come in with that. So whether it's 4 feet or if staff has some, they were talking about one full lane plus 8 feet. I mean, that's huge compared to what we're saying. And so I don't know if there's somewhere in between, but it seems to me that if 4 feet seems to me substantial, so – but I think it has to be some definite amount so that they can go right to the planning department and say this is mm-hmm. your responsibility, 4 feet. And
we are talking single family.
Yes.
It's at 4 feet average. So do you need me to restate the motion?
Well, the I think there is a motion that
there's
was
a motion on the floor in a second.
Right. And then there was a friendly amendment, and my question was one, whether there is a second as amended.
Yes.
And secondly, the point to clarify is that if the council is contemplating drawing a line at 4 feet average or whatever number, there may not be necessity for a hardship provision. In other words, if it is...
Or just say that we don't reimburse for that if we don't have the funds available. There are several different options that you could have.
Actually, I kind of like that idea. If could there be a time limit? Like, say, we agree to reimburse you within 3 years or 4 years of our street money for anything over the 4 feet. That gets it done right now. But it doesn't obligate us to go in the next day and spend
it will. Will we require prevailing wage to deal with that? But.
Now, when I came up with that idea, it was illegal. Now, why is it legal now? What's the difference?
It's still illegal. It's still too good of an idea. That's what's the problem.
Well, it's not illegal. It's just that it costs more.
No, it was spending public funds. Now, we're not.
Okay. Same answer.
Yeah, it's not illegal.
Okay, so we've had a motion and a second. We've had it amended and amended. So now can we have a roll call?
Let's be certain. Do you think you have the right motion we're voting on, Donna? And I think the city attorney is advising that if we put the 4 feet average in, then there's reason to have the hardship clause.
If it is the council's intention to define a certain amount that the owner will be responsible for that is less than what we now are considering to be a hardship case, in other words, to the halfway point or to the other traveling lanes or outside of the boundaries of their property, then a flat 4 feet average provision on a payout would eliminate any possibilities of hardship. So direction may be simply to amend the motion to exclude all the hardship provisions, and whether the existing ones need to be excluded, that's up to you as well.
It's been a long day for me, so I'm going to ask for explanation, because I still see that there's grounds for a hardship argument. We're saying 4 feet, which, you know, I'm hoping is acceptable. So we're saying a 4 foot average, but if the conform is much more extensive than that, isn't that the hardship argument that they bring back to the city? That's not what I'm grasping right now.
As I understood, what is being proposed is that the property owner, the applicant, would be responsible for paving out 4 feet from the curb line, irrespective of what the conform is or isn't.
Right.
And that the city would be responsible for paving out the rest or meeting the conform. So the hardship, unless the council is proposing that paving out 4 feet in some instances would create a hardship for the homeowner and allow him to appeal that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so we call
that's correct.
Okay, I agree.
Okay. So now, you have that off?
There's a little bit for everybody in there.
May we have roll call, please?
Behind this. Yes.
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 So the public hearing on this item will be continued to date certain.
November 15th.
Is November 15th the date that staff can meet?
Yes, for this one. Yes.
Until November 15th.
Thank you.
Okay. We are going to take a 10-minute break.
Well, I jinxed myself.
Yeah.
Well, if you didn't talk so much, I can hit fast. It's 8:30.
You're taking over 8 pounds, spot. You notice how short the meeting was last week when Nick Palm was in there?
Yeah, 7:30.
You guys didn't do anything.
You got to leave that last meeting alone. Stop right now.
Moving on to item 6, first reading of a zoning ordinance text amendment relating to the installation of utilities underground. Mr. Raper.
Mayor, members of the council, the methodology that was presented to the city council for curb gutters and sidewalks is pretty much the same. We use the same illustrations for undergrounding of utilities. One of the major differences as part of the ordinance amendment, the ordinance would exempt any new single-family infill construction as well as remodeling projects or additions in the residential zones. The proposed amendment would also exempt residential projects of one or two dwelling units, but would require the installation of underground utilities from the transmission line to the new units of two or more, and that would be from the Main Street back. Basically, you wouldn't have any overhead lines going in. Again, the staff report reiterates the multiplier effect rather than the value base, the method of calculation. Also, this proposed ordinance amendment is exempt under CEQA. As part of the ordinance discussion, what we have provided to you is the legislative style in terms of what the existing ordinance says and what is being proposed. I think on page 5 of the proposed ordinance, where we identify the exceptions under subsection B, again, what we're trying to really clarify is that where new single-family residential unit is constructed on one independent lot and industrial. And again, the same illustrations are used to illustrate where the 40% would go into effect for the three or more subdivisions or three or more PUDs or commercial and industrial type of developments. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Is there any questions of staff's report? Okay. This is a public hearing. I'll open it up to the public. Is there anyone who wants to speak on this item?
Bart Kellens, 891 Ninth Street. Mayor Santos, council members. More of a clarification a little bit from the business side. When new homes go up, they generate money for PG&E. They get a rebate to be able to install the electrical. When you have an existing home that does a remodel and they want to go from overhead to underground, that's where they get charged. If we can underground new homes so they look cleaner and their cost may be $300 to $400 compared to $3,000 to $10,000, we should be looking at that. And I don't think we should be sticking to that two or more units, because if somebody comes in and can afford to buy our property now in our city and it doesn't have a home on it right now, then they're going to get money back from PG&E, and it's not going to be that outrageous. What's happened, and I'm speaking from the Planning Commission side too, is that anytime we have these remodels that come in and we've been requiring people to go underground, it can be 15 feet or 20 feet, and it can cost $4,000 to underground their stuff. I think that's where this was heading from many, many years back, and we've been talking about it. So as we're looking at this ordinance, make sure that we still make every effort to underground the new homes that come in, because if you can afford to put up a new home and purchase that lot, you surely can afford that money overall, in my opinion. And as an electrical contractor, it doesn't make sense not to go to the, you know, when we call underground, it's primary lines and secondary lines. Primary are transmission lines that are the bigger lines. The secondary lines are the ones that go into the homes and stuff. And so unless it becomes a hardship like the last couple of things we've seen at the council meetings, we should leave that open for clarification, maybe under Jake, to say if they can do that and that pole is right there, let's get it underground. If it's a hardship because they can't go two or more lots or whatever has to work construction-wise to get there, then I can understand that. But let's see if we can make sure that we get that done, because of course it looks prettier, you don't have an eyesore, and actually from PG&E side, termination points for their home is a lot cleaner and neater weather-wise. So thank you.
Wait, Bart, before you leave, I had a question for you, being that you're an electrical contractor. So you're indicating that PG&E gives credits for new constructions to underground
for undergrounding for any type of hookup, because it's a revenue, and if it's something that existing, it's not new revenue,
right.
And they want to be able to make their 14 to 16% tax on whatever they're doing.
Right. Okay, so I understand that. Thank you. And the second is, I just want to get clarification. So based on being an electrical contractor, if there's a pole that needs to be relocated onto a neighbor's property line, you're still stating that you're okay with the exemption if it's going to be a hardship for a neighbor. Is that?
Means that there's no way you're going to, you know, price-wise, you could afford to underground those. But if you have a place, there was one on Newport, the Mitchells bought a piece of property, brand-new home, pole was right in the corner of their property, they undergrounded right over to it. I think it cost them $300 to hook up because they give you a certain amount of money back. And that's something that you'd have to call the center in San Luis, or Jake might have talked to them and stuff. But they get money back on that. In a sense, they don't get it back, but it's equated that, you know, it costs you $3,000. New lines are being put in. They have a certain procedure to go by. And at the end, you're just pretty much the cost is just a hookup for it, and that's it. So, and the other side is that if you do just upgrade a panel from overhead and stick with overhead, there's no cost for that at all. The electrician, of course, has to do their work, but PG&E just disconnects the power and reconnects it, so there's no money there either. So, does that make sense, Steve?
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for your time, you guys. Appreciate it.
Bart, before you go, I have one more question. Are you talking about undergrounding from point of connection to the right-of-way or to the pole, or are you talking about eliminating that pole altogether or moving that pole to the
location? No, being able to leave that pole where it's at, because most likely that's feeding about 2 to 3 homes.
Okay.
But being able to underground from that new home to that pole. And, you know, granted, what we had this last time is they had to go through two neighbors, and they didn't want to mess around with it. And I can totally understand that. But there is a lot of different situations. I probably can come up with 20 of them that you'd want to have somebody underground it. And if they're going through the process of a new house, it makes sense to go that way. And it's not, from the new construction point of view, it's not that more expensive either. So.
Actually, I think that was our direction when we talked to staff about this, that on a new home we were going to try to underground everything at least to the front of the property, so that somewhere in the long run, if that whole block is undergrounded, that's an easy connection.
The only reason, to
wherever that would be.
The interpretation was anything that was infill that was even new wasn't going to have it either. They would, you know, if somebody can come and go, hey, that's too much money for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we should, as the council, planning commission, you guys should look at that a little bit differently. I think we should be able to push to go underground from the house to that pole, as long as it's not a hardship. I'll use that word. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
One of the issues that, in discussing this with PG&E, that they talked about was that sometimes the pole that Bart's talking about isn't in proximity to that particular yard, that piece of property where there's a new house being constructed. And so just kind of a counterproductive situation occurs where they have to actually add a pole where there isn't one now, which has the, first of all, the impact of costing over $10,000, and then secondly, has the impact of adding to the visual blight just so you can underground something. So that part of where we understood council's direction was to avoid that kind of, adverse impact, and in terms of cost and in terms of the visual blight. I think part of we brought this to you in this context with the understanding of the direction that we thought we were getting. If you want to tweak that in some way, it seems like the potential is there for a kind of an appearance of a discriminatory approach. If sometimes an infill new home would require it and sometimes it wouldn't require it, it seems like there's some potential for exercising discretion in a way that may appear to be discriminatory. So we went with kind of vanilla here and as little complication as possible, trying to achieve what we thought your direction was.
Okay, this is a public hearing. Is there anyone else that wants to speak on this item? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, bring it back to council.
Mayor, I had a question, Jake. You mind if I start?
Sure, go ahead.
Jake, just because I keep reading it and don't understand it, on the front page here of your staff report, tell me what is required of two homes on one lot.
If they have a PUD and they create two lots to build two homes, what they would have is a utility line either along the street or back property line. What they would be required to do is drop a pole and extend the utilities from parcel one to parcel two underground. They would not be permitted to put a pole and serve overhead utility lines to that new construction.
How about a granny house or a second home on the same lot?
That one would be an extension of the utility line underground from the existing service to the pole. But again, it would not require them to add a new pole and drop a line and come in. So basically it'd be...
But in both scenarios, they have to underground from one house to the other.
Right. That would be the extent. They're exempted from undergrounding, but the intent is try to eliminate the overhead service lines to the homes for new construction. They wouldn't have, as Mr.
Confused.
As Bart says, if you have your primary line out front.
Yes.
Okay. And they come in to serve that. We want them to serve from the primary line to their home underground and to the secondary dwelling unit. If it's like a granny flat or a second dwelling unit and they have existing service overhead to the existing home, they may be able to serve that overhead to that existing home, but the objective is to not to have that overhead service line to that home.
Well, your sentence here says that you're exempt residential projects of one or two dwelling units.
Mm-hmm.
You're exempting them from undergrounding.
That's correct.
But then I thought you just tell me that you do underground.
Well, you don't underground the primary lines. And the big issue was the predated where that line is to accomplish the undergrounding.
But if it's on their property, is there a way to say you have to underground it?
You could. It makes a little ordinance a little bit more complex in terms of administration because, as Mr. Anderson stated, is that if the pole is on your next door neighbor's property and not directly on yours, then you would have to go out and have the utility plan do a judgment call. And one neighbor would have to underground, the other neighbor would have to.
No, I understand. That makes it more difficult. But what Bart suggested was, I would think that property owners would do that automatically. If you get underground and it was cheap and you were getting reversed for it anyway, they'd fall through on it. We'd all like to have them underground.
Yeah.
Anyway, you don't see how it would be an easy thing to write in the ordinance?
I don't think so, but we can certainly investigate it with maybe use some Bart's expertise and having some conversations with PG&E.
Well, it would be a case-by-case scenario. Obviously, it has to be on their own property and reasonable. And, anyway, thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Lieberman.
Thanks, and just wanted to piggyback on what David was saying. I think Bart raised a great point that we haven't been brought up to speed on was the PG&E participation on a new revenue stream. So encouraging new construction, new connections for service. I mean, couldn't we say we're going to require undergrounding on new construction where the pole is on the property line? I mean, then there's no real issue with approaching neighbors for easement access and all those other things.
Yeah, certainly we could do that as part of the ordinance. But again, if you have a new home in the middle of the block and being an infill parcel, both neighbors have overhead lines coming to their house off the line. And the pole is there, and it's serving two neighbors overhead, and then they have to underground from the same pole that serves their neighbors overhead. Some inequity exists there.
But again, even in that situation, I mean, and I'm sure you'll help us understand it better, it sounds as though the cost to that home builder in that infill mid-block lot is nominal. Mm-hmm. Right, even if that case, if the pole's in that person's yard, they're building a new home, it's serving other customers, and we say underground it. And if it's a new revenue stream to PG&E, it's a nominal cost.
That sounds like an excellent suggestion, and it's fairly easy to implement from staff, and we wouldn't be in a position of exercising some kind of discretion that could look like it's discriminatory. If you got a pole there, you underground. If you
exactly.
don't have one, you don't
it's
have
up to.
To
you.
And
it'll be an easy fix to the ordinance as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's all I have. Thanks.
Mayor Pro Tem Schultz.
Wow, I think they just solved it. So I'm thinking Councilman Lieberman should make a motion.
I couldn't make it
then.
If I wanted.
We'll have Donna read it.
Well, I'm not gonna be redundant because I agree with what was just said, and if staff feels that's an easy fix, then I think we should go in that direction. And then again, I just wanted to go back to the issue of requiring all.
Need it.
I'll take a shot at this. My motion is to amend the draft ordinance to include a requirement for new residential construction in an existing neighborhood to underground utilities if a existing pole's on the property line, and take Council Member Scholl, or Mayor Pro Tem, I'm sorry, Scholl's suggestion to exclude commercial, industrial, and multifamily residences from this ordinance and make it a requirement that they underground.
Do
second.
I have a second?
Second.
Okay, on a motion by Councilmember Lieberman, second by Councilmember Arnoldson. Roll call, please.
Yes.
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 Yes. Thank you.
And again, the public hearing will be continued to date certain for the first reading, which would be
November 15th
of this year.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on. Item 7, first reading of a zoning ordinance text amendment relating to the installation of a fire sprinkler system.
Mayor, members of the council, the same methodology applies to the proposed installation of fire sprinkler systems in terms of new construction and remodels, utilizing the 40% value, 40% multiplier, as a trigger for requiring the retrofitting of the existing structure, as well as a new portion being constructed for the installation of fire sprinkler systems. The ordinance modifies proposed modifications to the section 1003.2.1.1 of the Grover Beach Municipal Code for the fire sprinkling systems. Again, the multiplier for commercial and industrial areas and multiple family is the 40% multiplier, but the multiplier factor is 1.0 rather than the various multipliers as presented for single family residential development. Again, the ordinance is pretty brief and to the point, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to respond. Also in the audience is our fire chief. He has reviewed this ordinance, and I think he concurs with the proposed amendments as well.
Is there any questions of staff?
No.
This is a public hearing. We'll open it up to the public. Is there anyone in the public that has anything to say? Please come forward. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, bring it back to the council.
I move we continue this on to November 15th with directions to staff to eliminate the requirement or the exception for commercial, industrial, multiple family. So
and they require any additions to?
Commercial, industrial, and now, multiple family.
1,000-foot trigger?
Yes.
The
for new construction.
For new construction.
And then the existing ordinance identifies a 25% addition to the existing structures for triggering the requirement for.
Yes.
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 No.
No.
And again, the item would be continued for the public hearing for date certain of November 15, 2004.
Thank you.
I'm curious as to know the reasons for your no votes. If you guys...
They haven't supported...
If you guys would be so inclined.
Yeah, we haven't supported.
Is that what it has been? This is for the commercial, not residential. That's why I was curious. Before we move to the next one thing, I just wanted to thank staff for putting this in legislative draft. It was easy to read and easy to follow. So I wanted to acknowledge that you did respond to my request from the last meeting. Thank you.
No, it was great, actually. Much easier to follow.
And while we're there on fire, I would just like to thank our fire chief, and maybe you want to expand on the grant that we just received, sir.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of council. I am your fire chief, Terry Fiebig, as demonstrated by the patch on my right sleeve this evening. I'm proud to be here to let you know that the city of Grover Beach was successful in obtaining a grant through the what was formerly known as the Assistance to Firefighters Grant. It is administered through the Department of Homeland Security, and the fire department had applied for a grant to replace breathing apparatus, which was varied between 10 and 15 years old. The breathing apparatus, of course, is the equipment that we wear on our backs that allows us to breathe through a mask when we go into a structure that has a hazardous environment. Those breathing apparatus had become very old. A lot of them were literally falling apart as we were wearing them. They were not repairable because a lot of the parts were no longer available. So we've basically been taking equipment out of service as we've gone along over the last year or so. And additionally, there was a grant application made for a piece of equipment known as a compressor that is a high-pressure compressor that will allow us to fill the air bottles that we wear as part of this breathing apparatus right in the station now. And we were informed that there had been a slight modification made to our original request, and we were approved for approximately $147,000 that will allow us to purchase that breathing apparatus and the equipment to fill it. Of course, we will be coming to City Council for approval on the acceptance of that grant, but we are starting right now in that process to acquire that equipment.
I think what's wonderful is you explaining that to the public and the audience. People don't realize how expensive that equipment is, and it's for the betterment of the community. And I thank you so much for applying for that and receiving it.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on to council committee reports. Councilmember Lieber.
We're hopeful that we can have that ironed out in the next month or so. After that, we will be looking at using DCE and consultants to do some special constraints analysis. So I think the project is really starting to take shape. I think we're making great progress. And so with any luck and any hope, we can do this in less than 10 years. With respect to the EVC, I really have nothing to report this tonight, nothing to report from the League Housing Policy Committee. I have a SLOCOG meeting on Wednesday, and we'll report back to you at the next meeting, as well as South County Area Transit. And that's all I have this evening.
Okay. On the Park and Rec, we had a meeting, and three large items were pulled because our staff person was out ill. So that'll be coming on the next meeting. And I do want to congratulate him for a fine Halloween festivities. It was attended by all in costume stuff. Great acts.
Can I go back one time?
And then, the sanitation district, and one of the items is coming on is the cleaning of the canal and so forth, so I'll report back on that. And let me see, Mayor Pro Tem Scholes, you had a...
Yeah, I stole your invitation.
Thank you.
this is regarding Looks like there's a notice from Amtrak I had mentioned earlier about a second train coming into Grover Beach toward the end of November. This would be the train connecting the city of Los Angeles to the city of San Francisco. And I just happened to spy on your side of the dais. Looks like an invitation for Wednesday, November 17, 2004, where we are cordially invited to attend inaugural ceremonies announcing the start of additional Pacific Surfliner round-trip service between Los Angeles and San Luis Obispo, and that would include Grover Beach. So that's exciting, and I'm hoping to attend.
The only thing on here, Mayor Pro Tem, it says if we're going, where are we going to catch a train and where are we going to get off? Do you know?
Well, the route that is proposed would, in fact, have a stop in Grover Beach about midday, about 12 or 12:30. So you could catch that, and you can go either direction. Oh, you're talking about attending.
Yeah, if we attend, where is it going to leave us?
I was just talking about the new service into this into the community. We'll talk details afterwards.
Yeah, you have a thumb for.
Okay.
The exciting news is that there will be a second train coming into Grover Beach about midday, in which you can get on and go to Los Angeles or San Francisco, depending on your preference. And that's at the end, toward the end of November.
Can we vote to see where it leaves you?
Are you talking to John?
Both of you.
Can we contribute?
Yeah.
We can't.
How far away do you want to go?
What do you got, about another month or so?
Quack, quack, quack.
No, that was Aflac. Okay, moving on. City attorney's agenda, none at this time. City council agenda. I didn't do the city manager's agenda, excuse me. Okay.
Communications in the community.
We could report at this point that actually we're going to be meeting with the city of San Luis Obispo this week to discuss a proposal that they have to take us on as one of their client departments, in effect. And my understanding of our situation with regard to our website at this point is that we have exceeded the capacity that we are paying for. So so I think our future would be to incorporate those kinds of improvements in the website as we sit down and talk with San Luis Obispo about the kinds of services they may be willing to provide us. We will naturally be coming back to the council with the proposed agreement with those folks, and it may be best to defer that kind of improvement until we're switching to a different kind of host for our website.
Okay. Thank you for that report.
Okay, public communications. Any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total. Is there anybody who wants to come up and speak? Seeing none. Okay, moving on. Council communications.
I had one, and I know we have another agenda, but I'd like to talk for a minute about this view shed that was on your last agenda. When it came up as one of our goals, I was kind of skeptical because it's very hard to come up with something that meets everybody's desires. And I watched the program on TV. It was very informative, and I read the reports. And I'd like to just offer a little different viewpoint, I guess, on view shed. And it starts off with Al Dutra, who was an old-time council person here for many years. And his idea was that if whoever was here first had a view, it was theirs. You couldn't take it away from him. He was protect the old-timers, let whoever had it, go get your own somewhere else. That's mine. You know, don't build in front of me. From that, we went to something that was kind of a kinder, gentler thing where we talked about you shouldn't substantially or needlessly interfere with a view. And that was kind of trying to add some kind of good neighbor feelings into it. Please don't take all of my view because I enjoy it also. And that's where that all came from. And right now, we're going to something that
that although I agree that no one owns a view, I think we still need some of this good neighbor attitude, and our present one doesn't have that. It just says that you have the right to build a two-story home if you stay under the 15 and 25-foot height limits. I mean, it's automatic. You can put it anywhere you want. You can, and if you don't want a slope, you can build a 25-foot high building on the back of your lot, and this can take the entire view of some other person, and you haven't, because then it won't substantially or needlessly take all of your view. It's we're trying to get him to work together, and here it's just saying, no, you've got it right. Nobody wants a view. You want to take it. And I think that's the wrong message to send, and so I was hoping that when it comes back, we'd talk some more about somehow trying to encourage people to share views or recognize the value in a view and those that now have it, and why should you be able to just by right take it all? There should be some wordage or something that says, let's work together, let's all have part of a view, rather than you have the right to build it where you want regardless of what it destroys. So anyway, that was my comments on this. It's nothing to discuss now. It's just I think we've lost something of the good feeling, good neighbor attitude in our most recent view shed ordinance.
Okay.
So that was my comment.
David, I just wanted to comment on that. And I would certainly hope that neighbors or good neighbors are making an effort to get along. And I wonder at what point does a neighbor relationship versus city's business and city's policy, at what point do they collide? I mean, a lot of times we'll hear about things that are obviously civil issues between neighbors, and they want city involvement, and we always say that's a civil matter. You need to take that upon yourselves and work it out. I think the ordinance is the ordinance, and there's issues in there where neighbors that are impacted by it, there is a mechanism. But the bottom line is, if I want to build a second story in my house, I try to be a good neighbor. I'm going to go talk to my neighbors regardless of and independently of what the city policy is. I mean, the policy says I can do it, but I mean, I don't think we mandate through local legislation how people should behave themselves. You know, it's you are or you're not.
Well, I think our neighbors. But our just in defense of that, our existing ordinance talks about you shall not substantially or needlessly take all of someone's view. I mean, well, how much is substantial or how needlessly?
Yeah,
I mean, you can't. Mm-hmm. But it's a feel-good thing saying, let's work together. Mm-hmm. And so when you're reading that and you go to your architect and say, I want to design a house and I'm not supposed to substantially or needlessly take the view, they kind of think about, well, there is somebody else that has a view there. Whereas the current one now just says, you have the right to build it wherever you want, whatever happens, falls. You
know? Not to get into a long, drawn-out discussion, Dave, because okay. I think you're right. We can talk about this at another time, but let me just put two things out to you. There's nothing that we want people to be neighborly. We're going to be updating the land use element so we can have a policy that says, you know, let's work together to help save views. I think this ordinance that we're talking about is acknowledging that no one owns it, and we're just trying to give people an idea of what they can expect. I think the delicate balance is allowing someone to build on their property. Are you saying that everyone should go ask their neighbor to help design their project? I think the needless and necessary blockage of views was a difficult one to get into, so we can discuss it in detail.
Sure.
We'll discuss this when it's on the agenda.
Well, this could be a staff deal. It doesn't necessarily have to be in there. We could give direction to our planning.
Okay. Okay, moving on.
Well, excuse me.
I'm sorry, Ron.
Yeah.
Okay, 4.5 minutes. Let's go.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay if you want to speak.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John, talk.
You don't have to take this.
Go ahead.
You only have another month, man.
Okay. There's no
go ahead, you guys talk. I don't want to talk. Go ahead.
Is
Do we have a pacifier in the house?
put up the hallway pictures.
All right, moving on. This part of it's adjourned. We're going to move now to the Grover Beach Improvement Agency for Monday, November 1st. Can we have roll call, please?
Yes, I'm here.
Here.
Phew, it's warm in here.
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 Here. Public communications. There's nobody really wants to speak, but you have the opportunity to. Okay, moving on. Moving on to consent agenda.
I move approval of the consent agenda item IA1, please.
Second.
Okay, and a motion by Councilmember Lieberman, second by Mayor Pro Tem Scholes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Okay, moving on to business. IA2, proposed budget to facilitate redevelopment projects.
Honorable Chair, members of the Redevelopment Agency, as you're aware, the city and the agency have been exerting a very aggressive marketing program. In fact, some of the marketing materials are displayed here in the council chambers. And I know you had a presentation at your last meeting about some of the recent trips that we've made to market Grover Beach. What's happening is that we are becoming very successful, and a lot of interest is being generated among potential developers. They are coming to town, and they are asking staff questions about certain kinds of things. And one of the issues that often arises is finding a site that's large enough for certain kinds of developments. And when they don't find such a site, what they do is they come to us and say, are there some options for the agency to potentially assist in assembling land for larger parcels? And we indicate, of course, that those are tools that the agency has, but quite often they're asking for something that's kind of a step down from that, not as intensive as, say, looking at condemnation or something like that, eminent domain, but rather to get a sense of what are potential acquisitions that they could make on a private basis, but where not all the information is available or where assistance from local folks could be helpful. And in some cases, we're talking about developers who are also local and who are looking for that kind of assistance. Or surveying kinds of services, financial advice, legal advice, and so on. If we had an appropriation out there that would allow us to engage these kinds of professionals to assist the agency, then we could respond quickly to these potential opportunities. And if we are getting general direction from the agency and from the council to provide those kind of services by way of a budget appropriation, then that will allow us to move quickly on those things and capitalize on those potential opportunities. So staff has prepared a resolution that would amend the annual appropriation resolution, the agency's annual appropriation resolution, to provide $50,000 for those kinds of services. And we would recommend that the council or that the agency adopt that amendment to the annual appropriation resolution.
Is there any discussion? And is there anyone in the audience that wants to talk on this item? Seeing none. Do I have a motion?
There's no discussion.
Okay.
Is there a discussion?
I'd like to. I should have asked it on discussion. I'm sorry. But, how are you going to decide how to spend this money? Being a realtor, a lot of times gets a lot of clients. Some are serious, some are not, and to decide to do a number of appraisals or some other costly venture on someone who's really not serious.
Part of how we approach the
that concept is if somebody is already a property owner and is trying to figure out how to enlarge the parcel by acquiring properties around it, that's pretty obvious that they have made a financial commitment. Right. And so that would be the kind of situation that we would try to assist. If it's somebody coming in from out of town or somebody who's local who's trying to do something and they don't have a commitment in that area, they don't own property, they don't own options on property, then we would be more interested in some kind of a prospectus about what they're doing, what their resources are, and what their concepts are. And so we would need to have more justification from an individual that they really are serious.
Would that be now Suzanne and you collectively deciding? Who would decide this?
Actually, we have a team that deals with potential economic development, redevelopment activities that includes Gayla Chapman, the Administrative Services Director, includes Jake Reper, the Community Development Director, Suzanne, the Economic Development Consultant, mm-hmm. and myself. And if there are any potential legal issues involved in that, then we include Martin or Larry in that also.
Fine. Thank you.
Satisfactory?
Yes, sir.